or perhaps we could call it bad poems, some rather early poems, just a couple of them, and then leave a few in the middle, and then end with something I haven't read before at all. And so I have no idea either how long it will take or if I can follow it all the way through. Okay, that might be better. Can you hear that in the back? Okay. This, in fact, is a love poem. It's called The Cross-Eyed Lover. I have a friend, she says. I watch the silver minnow swimming in the shadow that flows between her breasts, caught on a silver string. There is a smile on her face. I know without looking. Homer went blind. Milton went blind looking. Justice went blind, looking too long at reason. Van Gogh sent the muse his ear as a token, if only he could keep on looking. She hung the sun between her burning yellow breasts, fried to a golden brown, the brain behind his eyes, bright blue to the end, and clear as glass. Cupid tied the bandage on himself. Under a layer of linen, a 46-year-old beautician from Detroit offers just as sweet a target as Brigitte. Only hanged men and little kids learn quickly enough how not to look through it. I have a friend myself. All day he peers at naked wenches sprawling on red velvet couches or artificial grass, upside down on 5 by 7 inches of ground glass. He says it is an art. I have an art myself. Fuad the fakir stares at the sun all day. All day he turns his whiskered puss to the sun. He knows damned well his eyes were burned out years ago. And what do you think he does after the sun goes down? Wouldn't you give your shell-like ear to know? My friend, Fuad, my pal, Milton, meet my wife, the muse. A silver mermaid leaps between her breasts, I know, without looking. Only a brassiere salesman in his blue suede shoes could look on her face long and not go blind. In order to read one of a series of three poems called Three for Robert Rauschenberg, the first one is called The White Paintings, and it refers in part to an incident in Rauschenberg's life that had always delighted me, in which Rauschenberg decided to see what he could do with, instead of painting or drawing, with erasing and obliterating everything. But he decided that it was impossible to start such a thing if he had to first produce what he was going to erase. So he decided to erase something that was already done by somebody else. And so he went to Bakunin and asked Bakunin whether he would give him a drawing to erase to see if there would be anything aesthetic left in this thing. At first, Bakunin responded, according to Rauschenberg, with the notion that there was some kind of destruction involved in this rather than creation. But he finally decided he would give him a drawing. He pulled out one drawing, and they said, no, this isn't good enough. And he pulled out a drawing he liked better and gave it to Rauschenberg, who spent a good deal of time and something like 34 different kinds of erasing materials until he finally decided that he had still something aesthetic left on the paper. He then framed it in a beautiful frame and put one of those little bronze, a little placket at the bottom, which said, "Erase Bakunin, Robert Rauschenberg, 1963. This begins with, he also did a lot of white paintings. They were simply all white. And he says of those, at the beginning of this poem, he says it for me, "I always thought of the white paintings as being not passive, but very, well, hypersensitive. erase a de Kooning to see if there remain on the paper traces of sanctification. What are you sanctifying next? After the first taste of pork on your innocent finger, there is no rest. You will eat crawling cheese. You will drink enough to be ill. You will coat your mouth with cayenne. You will stick needles between your fingers until you can't hold on to your horn. You will live to learn. We call the fool divine who first discovered wine. Like Leda, he knew exactly what to do in case of assault by a swan. Hang on. And we honor the first man to be gored by a bull to see if there would be anything beautiful left in the end. He wasn't led into Olympus for nothing. Like Pasiphae, he knew what he was doing. We set up for him in the Plaza de Mexico, before every performance, a Coca-Cola bottle 10 feet tall. There is something in this that reeks of the eternal feminine, this cool, hypersensitive white, like dawn, with only a few uncertain stars, this maidenly submission to the muse, like a temple virgin. Assaulted daily by the god who came disguised as a stranger, the painter turns from being man to being human, a tourist on whatever continent, in whatever cafe, talking about nothing but painting and hanging on. To paint a picture that has the dignity of not calling attention to itself. It is to stand for hours on end in the rain, like a pool of water, thinking of nothing but painting, no mean accomplishment for a natural man. I try to imagine the poem aspiring to the humility of prose, the poem saintly enough to be content to call attention to something beyond it himself. I contemplate the word holy enough to hide its light under a trademark, to say Coca-Cola to himself in a natural voice, over and over and over. The Gospel according to Satchmo, second verse, same as the first. If you gotta ask the question, baby, you're never gonna understand the answer. Now, to more recent things, this one actually is dedicated to our last president, George, gorgeous George. It's called Look Behind You, Pompey, and it refers to a time in Pompey's life in which he came back from a triumph, not in Iraq, but in Syria and in Palestine. Nevertheless, it was a triumph. And this is the description, fairly literal description, of the triumphal parade. Look behind you, Pompey. Here, now, Pompey in his gilded car, drawn by 4 white stallions, garbed like Jupiter, purple tunic, toga picked with golden stars. Ahead, the sweeps of ascendancy, the gall of defeat, Pharsalus, Memphis, death. Here, now, the streets masked with garlands and people, Io Triumphe. Magistrates, senators, trumpeters, and spoils, white bulls with gold gilded horns on their way to the sacrifice, captives in chains, Syrians, Pontians, Jews on their way to the axe. Ahead, the Circus Maximus, the Via Sacra, the Forum, the zigzag hill to the Temple of Jupiter, best and greatest. On his brow the wreath, in his left hand the ivory scepter, in his right the bay. Before him, priests, musicians, reek of incense, cry of lyre. Behind him, A slave holds high the golden crown of Jupiter, careful never to let it touch his brow. And behind the chariot, his lieutenants, tall plumes bobbing over bronze, alternately roaring songs in his honor, jests at his expense. And last, his soldiers, cohort after loyal cohort, trudging, lofting the eagle-topped standards, and the people shout, "Look behind you, Pompey. Remember, you are mortal." The invention of strangers, begins with an epigraph from Robert Ardrey, The Social Contract. It reads like this. "The prime foundation for the future of civil violence must be the invention of strangers. If we don't have strangers to fight, we will have to invent them," is what it's suggesting. In the ancient perpetual war between self and non-self, there's enmity everywhere. No need to invent it. Young blacks cruising the boulevards in battered Cadillacs, old Jews debouching from storefront synagogues in green-black overcoats and Assyrian beards, squatters, parvenus, barbarous, suspect, unaccountable. Nor are they always so simple to distinguish from non-combatants or friends. Even the dust is a stranger, crowding every aperture. Any moment some fanatical antibody might trigger a massacre. Transports of savagery, spasms of slaughter, clammy with shock, seething from scalp to soles, the ghetto gasps for breath. Somewhere under a mountain of outworn inventions, warriors are sleeping. Imperturbable torpor, shoulders lapped in epaulets of dust. Somewhere deep in the bowels of the city, a shadow slips from a doorway, cradling a shapeless burden, a weapon, an infant, a bundle of rags. Somewhere a baffled sentry bawls out, "Who goes there?" This poem starts out 2 years ago, but it's more like 20. But that's my license. I could show it to you, but you wouldn't be able to see it for a bit. It's called Piano Man. It's about a man who actually played the piano in this very place and in this very area for years. Some of you may recognize him. He's blind. 2 years ago, the coldest night of the year, coming home from a raggedy roadhouse gig, that blind smile froze on his face like a mask of ice. The snow lay round so thick he couldn't raise a peep from the pavement with his radar stick. A block to the left and 2.5 to the right, then he curled in an alley and slept the sleep of the numb, between 10 jiggers of whiskey and the weather. Hard luck pounded a rolling bass on his bones, but didn't he ramble through the intricate changes? Lighting up now, he clamps his cancer stick in blunt, frost-blackened fingers, close to the tip to steady it, a whiff of smoldering flesh. Can't work his zipper, so I wait till he fishes it out and dribbles over his shoes to zip him up. Has he heard, C asks, what they're doing now with lasers? He parries with that invincible blind man's smile. "Look, man, blindness is the least of my problems." And this thing is the long, dangerous recession. It's a poem called In the Clearing, which I wrote when I spent a couple of months in Vermont hiding from whoever there was to hide from. There were a lot of people to hide from. And it blunders through a lot of separate sections, just one right after the other. The only indications on the in the text are a little asterisk. And it, from time to time, brushes against little quotations, which I'm fond of. Some of them come actually from the notes that our landlady left as to the care of the house, the care of feeding the house. She titled them somewhat random thoughts. Some of them come from books as that I found that in her bookcase. One was called Wildly Successful Plants. On the other hand, she had Thoreau's Walden. I brought with me James Like's Chaos from the City. It seemed to me that it was the right thing to bring out into the country. There are also some quotes from William Carlos Williams and Conrad Lorenz, people like that. In the poem, I meet various critters, wildflowers, not-so-wild animals, and a wonderful cat named Sunshine, totally black, that I knew we would take care of. Luckily, we didn't have to take care of much else except all the plants in the house, and God, did she have lots of them that needed watering. But I left the garden to go completely to weeds, and it was a great pleasure because I like weeds. They're my favorite flowers. Being a city boy, a weed to me looks just like any flower to another person. So the poem really is a kind of ode to weeds, I think. They'll keep coming back again and again in the poem. Every once in a while, a man would come through and mow the lawn, and then the weeds would come back up the way. It's called In the Clearing. I'm going to read the first and the third section. This is section one. Independence Day, while for us the bugle sounds retreat. Down in the schoolyard, the fathers are offloading rockets, whereas off to the left, somebody's still driving piles, an implacable whack, whack of the hammer, a drum fire of progress. At the tip of each quivering dendrite dance 10,000 angels, brandishing rapiers or strumming molecular harps. Here in the clearing, hemmed in by honeysuckle, beleaguered by insults and promises, toxins and prophecies, switchblades and pheromones, swarming at every pore. It's keep treading, private. To pause is to drown. I'm pale as a corpse and stiff as a chrysalis. I've come to turn in my worm for a butterfly. Surrounded by windflower, speedwell, sweet yellow clover, I can let the angels enter one at a time. Few weeds are tolerant of shade. It was man who opened the sunny spots where weeds are happiest. How good to be back at headquarters, back at the threshold, between the labyrinth and the wilderness, one chaos and another, where mornings are sunny, evenings pensive, nights incontestable. How grand to greet the neighbors again by name, on speaking terms with ragweed and sow thistle, skullcap, burdock, bitterroot, and nettle. Intimate, familiar, thick as thieves. Time-wise, I made way for my cohorts, slashing and burning from here to the capital, without respite, without reflection. How sweet to be home again with my people, the consummate, sovereign, irresistible weed. Sunshine the cat will no doubt be your first concern, as he will insist upon being fed. Who is this dark lover come calling, this inky Maharaja, behind whom the underbrush is a palisade of black prairie and goldenrod. Black as the lips of silence, it's sunshine, strolling his minimalist grove, 15 red maples and 3 white pines, 18 dryads dancing on the barbered grass, a 3-dimensional frieze on an animate urn. He called this morning with a gift in his mouth, a vole clasping and unclasping the shadow in its elf-gray hand. Who's feeding whom? What sunshine's first concern? Unsettling how much the front door shut between us, his cry of triumph sounded like a howl of pain. What thing soever you desire, when you pray, believe that you receive them, and you shall have them. Reviewing the troops on the shelves of the upstairs study. Have you felt like giving up lately? Are you confused? The hunger for reality. I can all but savor the tang of the owner's convictions wafting from the pages. Penciled in the margin of how to pray. Prayers of 2 or more, when feeling the same burden, are very strong. And down in the living room, living in step, hey, I'm alive, the total woman, the book of trees, and what have we brought for sustenance? 1 copy of Chaos and 2 Rogers. All the plants will need watering. I will probably leave a few in the kitchen sink. In baskets, basins, clay pots, plastic, garden soil, potting soil, vermiculite, water, huddled on benches, railings, tables, lurking on windowsills, dangling from rafters, blooming, drooping, lush, tubercular, some under the weather, such as there is in here, some bushy-tailed, fresh as a hothouse daisy, yet all of them docile, self-deprecating, hushed and trusting, as if they were expecting us, housebroken like them, rich kin from the interior. The pond looks pretty only after a big rainstorm. There are apparently no underground springs, despite what the builder thought. Some pond, a crater in the grass with a bed of dusty mud tiles, flaunting that valence of lavender mimulus, a sort of dysfunctional rain trap, a brontosaurus print, an old war wound, and above, closing in on every side, that siege of horse mint and heelall, speedwell, skullcap, and wild marjoram, flourishing pennants of purple and blue, closing in like a legion of militant weeds. Sunshine's cutting through the maples, reconnoitering, appraising with his pale green non-Euclidean eye the lay of the land. Now he steps from the shadow and lets the trees get on with it, reading the future with their clairvoyant roots, praying to the dark star at the heart of their darkness. Sunlight leaps from his flank, a fusillade of shooting stars. Walden is blue at one time and green another, even from the same point of view. Last night's rain beaten the mimulus flat as a blanket. The floor of the pond is weeds from shore to shore. Ripples of jopai weed and wild marjoram. Ghost minnows of violet and lavender, winking and flickering. If I had a mind, I'd walk across it. Strange bird haranguing us from the evening wood. 1 3-note measure echoed relentlessly till even our obstinate hearts begin pounding in triplets. The third, part 3, begins with a quote from William Carlos Williams. The purpose of an orchestra is to organize those sounds and hold them to an assembled order in spite of the wrong note. A Prince of Weeds, the poem revisits its roots. It's been along a way too long, haunting the back of a classroom, waiting to be explicated. Down in the pit, the pond lays down a ground base, a drone of invisible bees. Out by the road, the chicory is crooning its indigo blues. The catbird chimes in with a clumsy fugue, never stumbling over the same note twice. Only a cat in quotes that black gnats hover round, as if to say, not quite. With that little black cap, it seems less like a song than a call to prayer. The poem sings along, not quite in tune. I do have a compost pile behind the woodshed, if you feel so inclined. Raking the hummock of compost down to the quick, watching the pill bug skitter, the centipede race, the termite lug her wings through the steaming humus, the slug wave his glistening palps in the emptiness. I saw the granddaddy of earthworms haul himself laboriously like a wounded titan from the abyss, a gash in his side from which the rancor leaped, where the teeth of my rake sank through like the fangs of chaos. Time to shovel fresh greens down the throat of decay. This morning's orange peel onto last year's beets. Winding diaphanous corn silk round ash-gray cobs. Scrambling the seasons. Damn the stratigraphy. Tearing a hole in the darkness to let in the day. Nothing but sunshine. You and me, nothing but sunshine, you and me, against the canonry of chaos. Nothing to flourish but his white teeth and our fine intentions. You armed with a novel, I with my who's who of weeds, marshaling the troops, inspecting the earthworks. What's marriage but a call to arms? Nothing but you and me and sunshine, marching to the pipes of the border guard. No tilling, dibbling, mulching, pruning, plowing, planting, reaping, gleaning, harrows, combines, herbicides, save every other Monday, one weed whip and one riding mower, only that momentary setback. Then Tuesday morning, the weeds crank up their tiny engines and resume their mild, affectionate forays. No digging sticks, no fertility rites, only the two of us now and then tending our own improbable garden, scattering in a rented bed doubtful seed on dubious ground, then strolling out through that glorious crop of plantain, yarrow, chickweed, bedstraw, skullcap, heelall, cinquefoil, sorrel, fertilized with nothing more or less than our unlikely love. And finally, from chaos, this system was robust. If you perturbed it slightly, as any natural system is slightly perturbed by noise, the strangeness would not go away. I love the terminology, chaos. Small noise, the snarl of the mower, the catbird's mew, the robin's mantra, me, 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 addressed to whomever it might concern. There are, after all, other systems yet more strange, where, should you let the moth of a whisker slip past your clenched teeth, all is irrevocably lost. Strange but robust, robust, yet exquisitely strange, the outlandish biomechanics of the birds, the maggoty dynamics of a compost pile, a pond of flowers, a garden lush with weeds. The ants have set their aphids out to graze by the pond on the giddy pasture of a cottonwood leaf, while the beetles keep munching and humping on the rose, and the sumacs flaunt their unlikely parasols, while sunshine sleeps inside on the easiest chair, and the asters carry on with their weedy amours, while the bee balm gossips with a potted fern through the living room window, and the sun rains down volley on volley of ultraviolet fire. One day's march through the marshes, then another, one flare in the darkness, illuminating for one drawn breath a corner of anyone's land. Dry pond and compost pile, sumac and honeysuckle. The poem cleans up behind it when it breaks camp, save for a rabble of yarrow squatting among the marigolds and a faint, ambiguous smile on the dayflower's lips. Sunshine comes round to have a word. It sounds like, "Now?" Leaps up onto the bench, a couple of brotherly jabs with his head in my ribs. Then he settles beside me to contemplate his kingdom. Not only is it improbable that the way back can be found, as speciation increases, the possibility decreases that any new route can be found. Time to pack up our tiny allotment of chaos. Time to retreat in earnest. Time to go home. For turbulence breeds its own improbable order, and the way back and ahead are one and the same. We take our clearings when and where we find them, and leave them when we go to their own devices. A few gifts pressed in a book like schoolgirl keepsakes, dry and flattened, etiolated, priceless. Thanks for your attention.